From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a Marine general tapped to head the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, sorting out the turmoil in Libya. Another major quake rocks Asia, and trying to understand the violence in Baltimore.
There is a huge drug problem. There are broken families. There's unemployment. There's corruption in the government. And therefore, these issues were simmering for a while.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama today will nominate Marine Corps Commandant General Joseph Dunford as the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the president's senior military advisor. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Dunford's selection comes at a challenging time with a rising China, resurgent Russia, operations in the Middle East and Africa targeting terrorist groups, and looming budget cuts.
The 59-year-old Dunford, only the second Marine to hold the post, has had a meteoric rise through the ranks after serving nearly 2 years as a regimental combat commander in Iraq. Patrick Bratton, director of diplomacy and military studies at Hawaii Pacific University, says Dunford's rapid advancement to four-star rank has been quicker than average.
A lot of his postings, you know, sometimes he's in there for a very short period of time. The way that his career has sort of worked, he's effectively jumped the two-star billet, actually, with the way that his billets have worked. He has both a reputation for very fast advancements of the ranks, and he's also kind of well-regarded as sort of a fighting commander. I think his nickname was Fighting Joe back in Iraq. Also been well-known as well for his coalition-allied contacts, a profile where he's got good links to sort of international military community with coalition partners, but also seems to be, at least his experience in Iraq, sort of well-regarded by the men who were serving underneath him.
Dunford served 18 months as commander of U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan before being named commandant of the Marine Corps last October. The post of JCS chairman requires Senate confirmation to a two-year term. The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican John McCain of Arizona, is quoted as calling Dunford an outstanding leader. He says he's extremely excited about his selection. The ranking Democrat on the committee, Jack Reed of Rhode Island, tweeted that he strongly supports Dunford's nomination, saying he has the experience and vision necessary to lead in these challenging times. Carl Baker, executive director of the Hawaii-based security think tank Pacific Forum, calls Dunford a good choice, likely to sail through the confirmation process because of his Washington connections and vast knowledge of both Iraq and Afghanistan. Baker says as chairman during Mr. Obama's last 2 years in office, Dunford will face a host of challenges with the fight against the Islamic State group or ISIS and a growing U.S. military presence in Iraq at the top of the list.
How do you deal with the restrictions we have on putting in ground forces? How do you deal with ISIS in general in the Middle East? Is going to be front and center on his plate. But you also have to remember that there's other regions out there. The Asia-Pacific is still out here, and of course, people have said this is going to be the test to see if the United States is really committed to its rebalance to Asia. And so I think that's going to be something that he's going to have to pay attention to. And, of course, that includes, paying attention to what China is up to out here and the commitment to the allies and all that.
Baker says Russia's actions in Ukraine have put a lot of strain on the NATO alliance, and that theater will also need the chairman's urgent attention. Bratton says what may make Dunford's job even more difficult is further looming automatic defense spending caps, known as sequestration, which were eased for 2 years in 2013, but set to return at the beginning of the 2016 budget cycle in October. If confirmed as JCS chairman, Dunford would succeed retiring Army General Martin Dempsey, who has served as chairman for 4 years. Mr. Obama is also expected to name Air Force General Paul Selva, currently commander of the U.S. Transportation Command, as vice chairman. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations envoy on Libya is backtracking on a peace proposal he put forward last week in the face of fierce opposition from one of the rival factions battling for power in the oil-rich country. Envoy Bernardino Leon described the proposal as a work in progress after the so-called Libya Dawn government that holds the capital Tripoli rejected it as a return to point zero. Libya Dawn said the UN plan is not based on a comprehensive, balanced solution to the Libyan conflict. The internationally recognized Libyan parliament, which operates from Tobruk, is said to be actively considering the UN envoy's proposal, which calls on all sides to respect last year's parliamentary elections that brought them to power. The plan recognizes the Tobruk administration as the only legislative authority for up to 2 years. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with pro-Tripoli lawmaker Al-Abu Zakouk about why the Tripoli parliament rejected the UN proposal.
The spokesman for it said clearly that the proposal by Mr. Leon is rejected because it has diverted from the points of agreement that they have discussed at meetings in Sokhairat and in other meetings too. So they consider it to be an unbalanced proposal, and they decided that it really brought the discussions 2.0, where both sides are each on the other side of the table.
But the original proposal presented at the talks had called for Tripoli and Tobruk governments to share authority. What happened after that?
One of the criticisms of the whole negotiations is that the two sides have never met face to face, which means Mr. Bernardino Leon was going in between. Now, each side could say, I haven't said that, you changed my opinion, and so on. They have to meet one face-to-face. If they cannot meet face-to-face, they should resign their positions and leave others come instead of them. Because if they want to be really real Libyans and genuinely wanting to have a consensual government, they have to meet each other. They have to be face-to-face. The question is, intransigence is from the Tobruk delegation. They don't want to consider the GNC, which is the legitimate institution according to the Supreme Court. They consider it to be null and void and dead. While the Supreme Court said that the Tobruk government and the Tobruk House of Representatives are null and void because they were based on a non-constitutional amendment.
One major problem was that the plan would also recognize the forces of General Haftar, who supports Tobruk, as a Libyan national army. Why would the conference have a problem with that? Isn't he the defense minister?
First of all, to come from the end, he's not the defense minister. Second, he has been assigned to this position 2 months ago. And we have also told the people, what about the 8 months before that, when he was bombarding Benghazi and all other cities? Wasn't he a rogue against the national government? The Attorney General of Libya has issued a warrant for his arrest. All of these things are there. Having been given by the Tobruk House of Representatives the title of commander of the national forces or the national army. And by the way, who are the national army? The remnants of Gaddafi army are coming back, led by another member of the Gaddafi free officers, who is Mr. Haftar. So now we are really and supported by Gaddafi Dam in Egypt and other remnants of Gaddafi regime, which means they are really coming back against the revolution of 17th of February. So he cannot be considered neither the commander of the Libyan army, and he is a criminal because he has destroyed Benghazi and he has fought with his forces against the legitimate institutions in Libya. The second point is that that is a point which needs to be agreed upon. Who will be taking care of the security in Libya? If both sides do not come to a solution for that one, believe me, there will be no peace. Because this security issue is number one, and it really takes priority over the political situation.
We hope to bring you more of Libyan parliamentarian Al-Abu Zakouk's remarks Wednesday on our program. Another major earthquake has rocked Asia, this time south of the Pacific island of New Britain, causing a minor tsunami of about 30 centimeters in Rabaul Harbor. The epicenter of today's 7.4 magnitude quake was about 130 kilometers south-southwest of Kokopo on New Britain. Matthew Mohoy is a seismologist at the Papua New Guinea Geophysical Observatory in the PNG capital of Port Moresby. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the quake is part of increasing seismic activity in the area so far this year.
We had a couple of events that happened before this. Last Thursday on the 30th of April, In the evening, there was one earthquake within the same area. It was measuring like 6.8 event. And then we also have another one on Friday evening within the same location. It measured 6.6 event. Yesterday, Monday, and over the weekend, we had a couple of like smaller ones in the mid-5s. And yesterday, we had like a couple of them. The largest was 5.6 yesterday. And then this morning, we had, the bigger of all of them, like 7.4, as UHS put it. But for us, we put it at 7.2.
Geoscience Australia said that the region has been very active recently, noting that a 7.7 magnitude earthquake occurred on March 30th, generating a local tsunami.
The one that happened in March, which is like, yes, again, the USGS gave it a 7.7, but I think it was further revised, and it gave us like 7.4, and it was just to the northwest of this current trend, just not too far from where the location of these events are. And it also did generate a small tsunami.
Does this kind of activity that you've noted in recent weeks suggest an uptick in seismic activity as opposed to the same period last year?
What happened was that in the last, corresponding period last year, we seem to have a kind of not that many activities. But like for this year, the same period, we're able to, experience this kind of, more intense activities happening in this part of the country. And we just don't know exactly what's happening. I think most of the, features there, the tectonic features and things, they're probably, I think all of a sudden they're trying to become active.
Do you see any linkage between this and last week's terrible earthquake that hit Nepal?
As you know, earthquakes happen everywhere in the world. The bigger one happened in Nepal. Does not mean that this one is kind of related. It could be one of those events that, occurs by chance, or it might be a coincidence, but right around the globe, earthquakes are happening everywhere. And so depending on, the stress buildup in all those, areas, there might be smaller events, there could be bigger events. So one big event elsewhere, like for example for this case now in Nepal, and then for us here in PNG, whether they are related, I'm not too sure, but I think they might be independent.
New Britain, the largest island of the Bismarck Archipelago, is east of Papua New Guinea with a population of about 500,000 people. It lies along the Pacific Australia Plate, which forms part of the so-called Ring of Fire, the arc of seismic faults around the Pacific region. The U.S. city of Baltimore is returning to normal after last week's riots that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray, a young black man who died while in police custody. Six officers involved in his arrest, three who are African-American, have been charged. Fahim Yunus is an executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. He tells us he's lived in Baltimore for more than 15 years and was near the epicenter of the unrest the day the violence broke out.
We went there right within 24 hours when the riots happened. And actually what I experienced were peaceful rallies. By the time I was there was, of course, a lot of law and order, a lot of police. And we were involved because we were called by a senior citizen center, which is adjacent to the CVS pharmacy that was burned down at West North Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue. And there were 62 senior citizens who did not have dinner that night. And they called on us that, can you provide food? And our community very quickly gathered, and we had food that we were delivering there. And when I was there, I saw actually very peaceful people.
Well, later on came the violence. So what is the reaction there in Baltimore to what happened to your city?
Yeah, I think people are very angry because this has been simmering for the past decades. The fact remains that 24% of people in Baltimore City live below the poverty line. And the fact remains that there are areas in Baltimore where the life expectancy is less than North Korea. There is huge drug problem. there are broken families, there's unemployment, there's corruption in the government. And therefore, these issues were simmering for a while. And now after, of course, nobody condones violence. Ahmadiyya Muslim community absolutely does not condone any violence or such protests or riots. But people are actually saying, look, I burned down a CVS and all of a sudden I get your attention, but someone comes and kills my son and that never gets the attention. So there is this deep, deep anger.
What is your community's, the Muslim community's, relationship with the police in Baltimore?
We have a very good relationship. Actually, we invite the police to our events, our national convention. We invite police to them. Anytime there is anything, since 9/11, we have an open-door policy. I'm saying this again, that anytime we can be of help to law enforcement agencies, we're always there.
And it seems that many Baltimoreans want to pull together now and rebuild the city.
That's exactly right. And I believe that's what people say. What will change in Baltimore? And to be honest with you, I think not much. I don't know how much can change because the issues are so deep. So I keep telling the group in Ahmadiyya Muslim community that we need to change. What I mean by that is people like us, we need to be more engaged in volunteering, in cleaning up the blocks, in helping out the schools rebuild, in mentoring the children. So I think that is happening. A lot of small groups, a lot of volunteers are coming together. People are realizing that their voices can be heard and they can make some small difference. As far as the politics is concerned, it's very difficult to say which direction it's going to go.
Do you think it's going to be a political issue now?
Absolutely. Everything is a political issue. Of course, there are already people are trying to turn it into a political wedge issue. This is Martin O'Malley is already saying, well, if I run for president, this will be my central issue. There are Al Sharpton was here from New York. The mayor is already very defensive, and she's trying to say, look, I want to move on. And there are others who are accusing the mayor of doing a bad job. And that does not help the average man on the street. That's another one thing which I felt that day, Susan, when I was there at the epicenter. People have deep mistrust. They believe everyone is there with an agenda. Everybody. They look at everybody with suspicion, and I think they are right because there are these secondary agendas. And when people turn these very real issues into politics, that divides us further.
Naeem Yunus, executive committee member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. Over the last 4 years, commemorative events to mark the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Civil War have brought thousands of visitors to battlefields and historic landmarks across the United States. The final event in the Civil War's sesquicentennial honors, the final journey home of the slain American President Abraham Lincoln. Kane Faribault in the Midwest state of Illinois reports for VOA Television.
To move the train and placing a hearse at 11 p.m. 150 years ago, right now.
150 years ago, on this windswept spot near Lake Michigan in Chicago, the coffin holding the remains of assassinated President Abraham Lincoln began a somber return to his hometown of Springfield.
It was total silence, and they took the coffin out of the train and through the large Gothic arch, 40 feet tall.
Dan Weinberg of the Abraham Lincoln Bookshop in Chicago says a concerted effort was made to remain faithful to the past while planning the 150th anniversary commemoration.
There were 36 states in the Union, and they had one young woman dressed in white with a crepe around the dress, each with a lily, that stood at the side of the hearse and then at the appointed moment walked around the hearse and placed the lily on the coffin.
Equally faithful to the events that unfolded 150 years ago was the carefully choreographed reenactment of the procession of Lincoln's body as it arrived in Springfield May 3rd, 1865. The replicated coffin and hearse that traveled through Springfield's downtown streets drew thousands of onlookers, young and old, many who dressed in ornately designed period military uniforms and costumes, like Diane and Charles Sanders.
This is a very special occasion. Lincoln was an Illinoisan. He was one of our favorite sons, as well as a renowned national figure.
Sanders says the massive turnout for this event 150 years later is a testament to Lincoln's lasting legacy as the great emancipator who ended slavery in the United States.
People of all races, people of all persuasions identify with what Lincoln stood for. And we're trying to reconnect today. We're coming back to that. We're trying to reconnect with what Lincoln stood for and what he did.
He's more of a myth than a man.
Pamon Rami of the DuSable Museum of African American History says Abraham Lincoln's assassination on April 15, 1865, at the close of the Civil War, elevated the 16th president's status in America's collective memory.
It's by no accident that we remember the fact that he was murdered. You know, as Frederick Douglass said, had he maybe lived to be an old man, our appreciation might have been different, you know. So I think people will always look back and be questioning and judging the impact that he had.
But in the crowd of history enthusiasts who gathered in Springfield, the lens of time focuses on the legacy of one of the most well-known and respected figures in American history. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Springfield, Illinois.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently participated in the fifth round of the U.S.-Colombia High-Level Partnership Dialogue in Bogota. In his opening remarks, Deputy Secretary Blinken noted that progress Colombia has made since the first dialogue 5 years ago comes as a result of the courage and resilience of the Colombian people, who are translating steady economic and security gains into a strong foundation for shared prosperity and peace. Among the many areas of cooperation, the United States announced that the U.S. Agency for International Development intends to provide $800,000 to the Organization of American States to support Colombia's peace process and verify land restitution, reparation, truth-telling and reconciliation, peace and transitional justice, and disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of former combatants. The United States firmly supports Colombian efforts to build the just and durable peace its people deserve. To bolster and expand Colombia's humanitarian demining efforts, the United States also announced an additional $5 million over the next 2 years for civilian and military demining activities. Since 2006, the United States has provided more than $21 million to clear mines so that farmers can plant and children can play outside and walk to school without fear of losing their limbs or lives. The United States also underscored its strong support of Colombia's efforts to promote sustainable energy resource development. That is why USAID announced an $18.5 million program with the Colombian Ministry of Mines and Energy aimed at developing renewable energy and energy efficiency. We are also collaborating on developing the first solar decathlon in Latin America in Cali. The U.S. and Colombia are also identifying ways to help unlock the potential of young people, especially women and girls. Through President Barack Obama's Women's Entrepreneurship in the Americas initiative, women have learned how to use low-cost technology to grow their businesses. In addition, the 100,000 Strong in the Americas initiative is increasing learning and understanding as more Colombian and American students study in one another's countries. The United States and Colombia have seen our relationship move to a true partnership. Indeed, according to Deputy Secretary Blinken, we used to ask, what can the United States do for Colombia? Now it is, what can we do with Colombia? And that is a tremendous opportunity for the United States, and we believe for Colombia as well.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.